This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm Joe Ramsey. The United States and Germany advised their nationals in Afghanistan to avoid traveling to Kabul Airport on Saturday, citing security risks as thousands gather trying to flee the country almost a week after Taliban Islamists took control. Crowds have grown at the airport in the heat of the dust of the day over the last week, with mothers, fathers, and children pushed up against concrete walls in the crush as they seek to get a flight out. The Taliban have urged those without travel documents to go home. At least 12 people have been killed in and around the single runway airfield since Sunday, according to NATO and Taliban officials. The Taliban are still trying to hammer out a new government, and the group's co-founder, Mullah Baradar, arrived in Kabul for talks with other leaders on Saturday. The group's lightning advance across the country as U.S.-led forces pulled out, coinciding with German Chancellor Angela Merkel described on Saturday as the, quote, breathtaking collapse of the Afghan army, sparked a fear to overturn a harsh version of Islamic law the Taliban exercised when they were in power 2 decades ago. The U.S. has evacuated 2,500 Americans from Kabul over the past week, senior U.S. officials said on Saturday, adding that Washington was fighting against time and space to evacuate people from Afghanistan. Chad's government announced Saturday it has to halve its contingent in the multinational G5 Sahel force in the troubled Three Borders region of Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso, recalling 600 soldiers. Chad's 1,200-strong contingent was deployed there to fight the jihadists, part of a force to which all five of the Sahel region countries have contributed to since 2017. Find more at voanews.com or on the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News. Thousands of people demonstrated in the streets of France again on Saturday against the government's COVID-19 vaccination policies amid concern from rights groups about anti-Semitic sentiment in the protest movement. Saturday's protests were called for the sixth weekend in a row to denounce a new quote-unquote health pass system announced by President Emmanuel Macron that they see as unfairly restricting the rights of the unvaccinated. Under the system introduced progressively since mid-July, anyone wishing to enter a restaurant, theater, cinema, long-distance train, or large shopping center must show proof of vaccination or a negative test. Around 200,000 people have marched in previous weekends, according to Interior Ministry figures, while organizers claim the real number is nearly double that. The government insists the pass is necessary to encourage vaccine uptake and avoid a fourth national lockdown, with the unvaccinated making up 8 or 9 out of every 10 COVID-19 patients admitted to the hospital. German police said Saturday thieves have made away with copper plates of, quote, significant material and historical value from the entrance buildings of Berlin's Victory Column Monument. Authorities in Berlin say repair workers had discovered that the, quote, big parts of the plates covering the roofs were missing on Friday. Local newspaper BZ reports the damage reached several hundred thousand euros and 3 of the 4 entrance buildings were hit. The Victory Column, standing in central Berlin, is one of the capital's most recognizable landmarks. Germany's monuments and museums have been hit by several high-profile threats in the last few years. Tensions in Haiti are rising on Saturday, 1 week after a devastating earthquake killed more than 2,000 people. Scant aid is arriving in remote regions of the impoverished Caribbean nation. Most Haitians, whose homes and livelihoods were destroyed by the magnitude 7.2 quake that struck last Saturday morning, and many say they're unsure how to even start rebuilding. The official death toll from the earthquake stands at 2,189 people, with an estimated 332 still missing. But residents in towns across the southern rural countryside are still digging for bodies believed to lie underneath the rubble. Tens of thousands of homes are in ruins, leaving many families with no option but to sleep outside despite torrential downpours at night. Despair and frustration over the lack of aid began to boil over on Friday, with residents attacking aid trucks in multiple towns across the south. Again, the official death toll from last Saturday's quake is 2,189 people. Back in 2010, more than 200,000 were killed in an earthquake that the island is still recovering from. Find more at voanews.com. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga.
We have the capacity, we have the place, we have the land. At any rate, as I mentioned, we are still in the discussions. We will be discussing what are our obligations, what are our responsibilities, and what are the obligations and responsibilities of our partners in this operation.
Uganda's foreign minister on talks with the U.S. administration about providing assistance to refugees from Afghanistan.
We've been especially using our social media pages to try and highlight frequently asked questions. We want to improve that by trying to make it a little bit lively so that people can engage with one or two people who are able to answer real-time any kind of misinformation they may be having.
Volunteers in Kenya are working to counter misinformation on the coronavirus among people living with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS.
Once we restore the rule of law, once we restore order, let me say that, it's an ingredient to economic. Once we restore the rule of law, you'll see more investment. You'll see more economic activity. We start from there.
And Zambia's newly elected president, Hakainde Hichilema, says he plans to unveil a new set of economic policies. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Uganda's foreign minister says the talks with the administration in Washington have yet to conclude about providing assistance to refugees from Afghanistan. General Alhaji Abubakar Odongo JJ says his country has the capacity to offer 2,000 Afghans a safe refuge. His remarks come after President Yoweri Museveni pledged the East African country's readiness to provide assistance, including temporarily housing refugees from Afghanistan. General JJ spoke yesterday with my colleague Peter Klote. In this excerpt from their conversation, he speaks about the Afghan refugee situation.
Now, when it became necessary, the United States reached out to its international partners with a request if they could host some of those people they will be moving out of Afghanistan temporarily. One of their partners they reached out to is Uganda. You may wish to know that Uganda was reached because of its exemplary history in the management of refugees and its history of humanity in as far as people in distress are concerned. So when we were approached, we were happy to receive when the time comes for that. But as we speak right now, we have not yet reached any conclusive decision as to whether these people will come, when they will come, how many will come, which type of people will come. So we are still in contact with our friends and colleagues in the United States government on these matters. But no firm decision has yet been made.
Mr. Foreign Minister, some people have been worried about the impact of what is happening in Afghanistan so far on the security situation across Africa. What is your take?
First of all, it is true, it may have some security implications. But what is also important for us to know is that that can only be temporary. The ultimate solution is for us in Africa to build capacity, to build resilience, to be able to deal with the situations of that nature, if they should arise.
Now, Uganda hosts about 1.5 million refugees, the most of any country in the world. Do you think that an additional 200,000 Afghans promised by your government, you have the capacity to handle that?
No, the figure is not 200,000. The figure is just 2,000. We have the capacity, we have the place, we have the land. At any rate, as I mentioned, we are still in discussions. We will be discussing what are our obligations, what are our responsibilities, and what are the obligations and responsibilities of our partners in this operation. So it will not be entirely a Ugandan thing.
Volunteers in Kenya are working to counter misinformation on the coronavirus among people living with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Social media posts have been circulating harmful, false claims that the use of antiretroviral drugs to treat HIV can also prevent and even cure COVID-19. Victoria Amunga reports from Nairobi.
The Kenya AIDS and Governmental Organizations Consortium, KANCO, has been hosting regular forums to educate HIV patients on preventing coronavirus infections. The group's clinician Robert Kisia says the need came because of false claims in social media that antiretroviral drugs used to treat HIV also prevent or even cure COVID-19.
They are like COVID is a virus. And HIV on its own is a virus itself. So they are like, if these drugs are antiviral, why aren't they covering up for, why are they covering up for the HIV alone? So me, I tend to believe if I'm on ARV for HIV, the same drug can work on the COVID.
HIV patient Jen, not her real name, has been using antiretroviral drugs, ARVs, for 5 years. She fell for social media claims that the ARVs will protect her from COVID, partly because she was afraid to take the vaccine. She says, I'm now ready to take the vaccine because we went for training and were educated that the moment you get the vaccine, your chance of getting COVID is lower than someone who hasn't vaccinated. Kenyan authorities are campaigning to counter the falsehood through community sensitization and media. Willis Akwale is the chairman of Kenya's Vaccine Deployment Task Force.
We've been especially using our social media pages to try and highlight frequently asked questions. We want to improve that by trying to make it a little bit lively so that people can engage with one or two people who are able to answer real-time any kind of misinformation they may be having.
KANCO's Key Population Project has also been reaching out to HIV patients. The project's program manager, Sylvia Ayona, explains how.
Through a process of trying to reach out to people, even in their homes, using their peers, and in our health centers, we have within the static sites, we have a clinician or the counselors who were charged with the responsibility of conveying correct information about COVID as part of their routine service delivery.
Activists and authorities hope to reach the estimated 1.5 million Kenyans living with HIV with accurate information on coronavirus. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Commemoration events are being held in South Africa this week for 34 miners shot dead by police during a strike at a platinum mine near the town of Rustenburg in 2012. The incident became known as the Marikana Massacre and was the most lethal use of force by South African police since 1960. In 2015, a judge recommended that the police who opened fire on miners, some who were armed with clubs, spears, and other weapons, be investigated. No such a probe has ever taken place. As Darren Taylor reports, relatives of those who lost their lives feel let down by South Africa's justice system.
In the build-up to the shootings, miners striking for better wages killed two police officers. At the time, Cyril Ramaphosa, now South Africa's president, was a non-executive director of the Lonmin Group, which owned the mine. As the strike grew increasingly violent, Ramaphosa called for concomitant action to be taken against miners. But the judge who led the inquiry exonerated him from any responsibility for the killings. The inquiry did, however, question the fitness for office of now-retired police commissioner Ria Piecha, and the actions of then Police Minister Nathi Mtetwa. It also condemned the police for using excessive force. But no one has ever been charged for any criminal offence connected to the shootings.
9 years on, still no justice.
Musi Maimane was a senior member of the opposition Democratic Alliance when the Marikana massacre happened.
We cannot cheapen the lives of miners, all in the interest of extracting resources for the benefits of a few at the expense of the many.
He says the African National Congress, or ANC, government has covered up the truth about what happened at the mine.
I asked her that day, I said to her, Ria, who gave the order to send mortuaries and to send bullets to the people? She still could not answer. I still have not gotten answers.
He, like many other South Africans, believes that while police pulled the triggers, senior ANC politicians were pulling the strings behind the scenes.
That's why none of them have been arrested and none of them have been charged, whilst in fact the orders would have come from the top to ensure that live ammunition in a democratic government was used against the poor of this nation who were simply demanding not just a wage, but dignity.
The state has, however, paid some reparations to relatives of the slain miners. Solicitor General for the Department of Justice, Fedzisani Pandalani, says it settled 35 of 36 claims brought against it by families of the Marikana victims.
The quantum of the amount that has been paid to date is 69,083,000 rands.
But Pandalani says the group representing the families, the Socio-Economic Rights Institute, has made a further demand of general and constitutional damages.
We believe that we, as the state, we needed to approach this matter with some degree of humanity. We then said we are prepared as government to pay to all the claimants an additional 500,000 rand without prejudice, of course. That offer has been rejected. I think it must be placed on record that that offer has been rejected.
The Institute's demanding an additional 1.5 million rands for each of the miners' families. Pandalani says the state's hoping a compromise can be reached. Meanwhile, the relatives of the Marikana victims say they'll take the money because they need it, but they'd rather go to court to see punishment for those who shot their loved ones dead. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Mali has gone through two military coups in the past year. Recently, Mali Foreign Minister Abdoulaye Diop was in Washington to meet with U.S. officials. The United States has been a key partner in the group of five Sahel nations: Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania, and Niger, that are battling insurgent groups and intercommunal violence. Diop says his mission was to strengthen the relationship with the U.S. and explain how the current government, led by coup leader Assimi Goïta, is handling its promised transition to democracy. VOA's Bambara Modibo Dembele sat down with Foreign Minister Diop a few days ago to talk about the country's challenges. In this excerpt of their conversation, they start by discussing how the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan and how it might affect the G5 Sahel effort.
We are very much, we are very much concerned by the latest development in Afghanistan with the pullout of the American military. There are many comparisons in the media about the likelihood of the repetition of such event in Mali. We are saying comparison is not reason, and what is happening in Afghanistan, Afghanistan is not Mali. With that in mind, what is important for us and what lesson anyone can learn from what happened in Afghanistan is that no country, no people, no government should subcontract its security to another state. So that should always be the responsibility of a country and the people. Mali thinks that we want to continue to work with our partners. We want their contribution, but the main responsibility should remain with ourselves. We today in Mali, President Assimi Goïta, the government, and Malian people are also in that mindset, in that spirit, that our security and our stability is in our own hands. We have to do every effort to ensure our own security. We have to equip our military with the strategies, the equipment, and all the tools and that they need to fulfill their mission. And we remain open to collaboration, to partnership, to support. But definitely, everyone should continue to reflect on the implication of what has happened in Afghanistan.
During your last trip in Algeria, you stated that dialogue with terrorist group is a question of a sovereignty. So how to reconcile the vision of the Sharia with the principle of the secularism?
Okay, if we say the sovereignty, it means that these type of political problems, their resolution is in the hands of Malian. It's up to Malian to decide how they want to run their country and what are the solutions to solving Malian problems. As you know, we had a conference d'entente nationale, which is a kind of reconciliation conference held in Mali in 2016. And then we also had the national inclusive dialogue held in 2019. Both have recommended that we should be talking to the radical groups which claim to be Malian, not the foreigners, but the Malian. But in our view, this cannot be done in the vacuum. It has to be done in the midst and in full respect of some key principle of Malian constitution, the respect of our territorial integrity, the respect for Malian sovereignty, the respect of the secular nature and the democratic nature of the Malian Republic. If those principles are followed and respected, we think that there is no reason that Malians should not talk to each other to find a solution to their problem. This is also is being done with the mindset that unless we decide to wage an indeterminate military venture against the terrorists, or at some point we will stop to say, okay, the military approach to terrorism should continue. Of course, it will be the first line of defense, but also we need to look at the second possibility or the second option to engage in for political solution, to talk to our communities, to talk to our young people, to see where we see the negative influence of the terrorist group in our community, to sit down, to have a dialogue with them, to what are the reasons behind their involvement? Is it for economic reason? Is it the lack of job? How can we get our young people? What type of de-radicalization process we can put in place? Remember, Mali is the country of Timbuktu, is the country of a secular Islam, a tolerance Islam from the time of Mansa Musa. So Islam is not new. If anyone is trying to teach us an Islam that is not tolerant, that is not open, that does not respect the need to have different religions side by side, and definitely this Malian will not recognize themselves. So this is what we are saying, to have a dialogue with the communities, as our president said, but also to have a dialogue with the radical group who will respect the founding documents of Mali.
That was Abdoulaye Diop, the foreign minister of Mali, speaking with VOA's Modibo Dembele from our Bambara service. Zambia's newly elected president, Hakainde Hichilema, says he plans to unveil a new set of economic policies after his official installation on August 24th. He made the announcement at a news briefing at his home in the new Kanyama district in the capital, Lusaka. Hichilema says his plans are aimed at jumpstarting the economy, tackling external debt, taming inflation, creating jobs for youth, and inspiring the confidence of international investors. VOA's Peter Kilote has this report from the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
Bali will fix it was a major election campaign slogan for Hakainde Hichilema, meaning "Father will fix it." Hichilema says his experience as a successful businessman and one of the richest men in the country uniquely places him to find solutions to the economic challenges facing the country. Chibamba Kanyama, a prominent Zambia economist, says the president-elect will have to contend with a myriad of challenges, including crashing debt, as he tries to jumpstart the slumping economy.
The first is the debt. This is both the domestic and external debt. And we call this the elephant in the room for Zambia. At the moment, this is a big problem because our debt-to-GDP ratio is in fact now over 100%. The second one is unemployment. Unemployment levels are significantly high, and the third has to do with the mines.
According to the Database Trading Economics Global Macro Models and Analysis, Zambia's unemployment rate is expected to top 15% this year. An African Development Bank report shows the economy fell into a deep recession due to the global economic pandemic, contracting nearly 5%. It also warned the government to stop accumulating external debt and curb sharply rising public spending to attain debt sustainability. The warning came after Zambia became the first African country to miss interest payment of $42.5 million on $3 billion worth of bonds. Kanyama says the external debt of $12 billion is unsustainable. Hichilema says the debt is choking development. At the news conference, he said his administration's economic policies will encourage foreign investors to do business in Zambia. He plans to hold negotiations with lenders as part of the effort to ease some of the economic pressure from the debt.
Today is the day I can say to the debt stockholders that we have a new administration that will take debt seriously, that will not sit and wait until it defaults without talking to you. So come to the table. We will discuss the options that are available. We will ensure that there's equity in the treatment of your debt. We will not ask you to come to the table to discuss your debt, and we do an arrangement with you that will allow us the headroom to release resources and apply those resources on the equation side of investment, revenue generation, and not consumption.
The prevailing economic conditions, economists say, do not inspire investor confidence. The president-elect agrees and promises to reverse that perception.
Once we restore the rule of law, once we restore order, let me say that, it's an ingredient to economic. Once we restore the rule of law, you will see more investment. You will see more economic activity. We start from there.
Kanyama says the new administration must find solutions to the recent nationalization of underperforming copper mines by the outgoing administration. He says the government has had a poor record of managing mining companies over the years. Kanyama also says agriculture is one of the sectors of the economy that can give Hichilema a quick win if his policies help farmers and attract youth to agriculture to reduce unemployment.
It is about agriculture, which has really not done as well as we anticipated it. So the president has to address it. The other one is to inspire confidence and promote national unity. The country has been divided on tribal and regional lines.
Hichilema, a farmer who routinely describes himself as a little cattle boy, says his administration plans to boost agriculture with new economic incentives. There also will be support for youth, he says, to become entrepreneurs and business owners to reduce unemployment. Zambians say they look forward to the new president fulfilling his promise to create jobs, reducing the inflation rate of nearly 18% and improving living conditions. For VOA, I'm Peter Clote reporting from the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Batty, host of your breakfast show, Daybreak Africa. As always, our newsroom is on top of the news of your interest. We provide you with up-to-the-minute news about Africa as well as world news. Tune in to our show right here on VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.
This is the Voice of America in Washington, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. And see to come in the program, our Saturday music spot from our collection of music from across the continent. But first,
Zimbabwe recently scrapped rules requiring sole state ownership for cannabis farming to encourage investment in the plant for industrial and medicinal uses. Zimbabwe is Africa's largest tobacco producer, but authorities expect hemp export earnings to start replacing it as farmers seek higher earnings. Columbus Mavunga reports from the Beatrice farming area in Zimbabwe.
We are in a 4 hectares hemp field of farmer Jesper Kek, about an hour's drive south of Harare. He has been growing mainly tobacco since he moved to this 250-hectare farm 5 years ago. Kek now plans to increase his hectareage of hemp, a type of cannabis plant that has low levels of THC, the intoxicating substance in marijuana, when the growing season begins in a few months' time.
So I went for hemp because it's an export crop, a much more reliable market. For example, potatoes, local crop, the market's a little bit unstable in terms of the number of people are growing and selling into such a small market. So I wanted a slightly more stable crop in terms of the demand.
About 5 years ago, Zimbabwe Industrial Hemp Trust led experiments raising cannabis, and the project has spread to several parts of Zimbabwe. The trust is providing technical assistance and looking for markets for farmers, says the group's head, Dr. Zorodzai Maroweke. She says Zimbabwe is making a smart choice with cannabis since the tobacco market is shrinking because of anti-smoking campaigns.
It's most relevant now considering the threat that the tobacco industry faces, and knowing very well that Zimbabwe heavily depends on tobacco production, it's relevant that our economy has to start looking at alternative cash crops, and I think industrial hemp tops the list. It's a green crop, and there is a lot of social impact in comparison to tobacco. I think in the next 10 years, definitely we'll see the value chains that will come out of this sector are way more than tobacco.
While Kek is thinking of exporting his crop, Walter Ruprecht has used some hemp produced by farmers this year to produce paper. He says cannabis has a lot of potential for Zimbabwean, both for industrial and even medicinal use.
The advantages are obviously that it's going to create thousands of jobs. I mean, just in the farming areas, just like tobacco has done for decades. Hemp obviously has many advantages for its medicinal interests at the moment. However, there's huge other composites available that can be used, such as textiles, pulp and paper. It's a nitrogen supplement to the soil. It eliminates weeds. It has so many advantages for the small-scale farmer. And then, of course, the value chains, which stretch into hundreds of thousands of dollars of opportunity.
The global cannabis industry is expected to be a $46 billion business worldwide in 3 years, up from $16.47 billion this year, says Tino Kashamba of the Zimbabwe Investment Development Agency.
It's a market that's growing fast, and we think this is going to be a game changer for this country. And Zimbabwe has also gone a step further to show that it is willing to work with its partners and investors, you know, by coming up with an investment stability agreement, which basically further protects you against anything like expropriation or changes in law. So, which is also quite great.
Because of the new cannabis regulations, Kambasha added, Zimbabwe has attracted investors from the US, Britain, Germany, Switzerland, and other countries. That might be a needed shot in the arm for Zimbabwe's economy, which has been stuck in the doldrums for more than 20 years. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Beatrice, Zimbabwe.
It's now time for our Saturday music spot. Yes, time to relax and enjoy great African music.
Filomeniweza na penzi lako nimelewa chakari.
malaria no be STD. Green wa be TLC. Umada be not the ESC. I want drop all of busy welder. Kaki no be leather. Slim case, yeah, me the brainy anti release.
Popo wa Akishi Becker.
Oh yeah, we, what's the matter? I chop me money, I chop me data. Send the answer. Shake me, shake me, bum bum bum. Like in your package, filling the package, making the boys do na na na. Antiques you go down, 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 even down. I see you they sweep ground, oh yeah. Brother, show that, yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. The money they make me the baby body, baby body, baby body. The girl is hot, like yeah, 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 yeah. Money they make me the baby body, baby body.
Fire waste, 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 fire
in my mandula. You just a bust in my mandula. You know be regular.
Chopsticks. sura unasema wanipenda ila maisha yangu maseke michecha milenda ndo menyu yangu na ya kuku mateke yanichenga kila siku kilio salini micheke sina tenda ugali buguru ni mboga temeke na furahi umeniridhia niwe na wewe kimwali maisha yangu mitiani isoisha maswali ukifika nyumbani kumilia wana hali sio shwari asubuhi mchana paka jioni ndo kula futari tena huku kwetu muda wote mateja anatinga miwaro vyetu ukifua kumbuka kuvilinda huku kwetu muda wote mateja anatinga mwami wewe swala la nyumba na gari mi bado na mwanga nimepanga bado yeah mi bado sina hata kiwanja bado ukienda sokoni kariri vichochoro geto na mkeka tu hakuna kitanda shuka wala godoro heka heka hakuna kibatali na ningiza totoro fuwa ikinyesha nyumba inageuka kapoti ya komoro hila nimesha kupa mtima kija kususa tanizika mzima nimesha kupa mtima kija kususa tanizika mzima tena huku kwetu muda wote mateja anatinga miwaro vyetu ukifua kumbuka kuvilinda huku kwetu muda wote mateja anatinga
was our Saturday music spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America and from the rest of the Nightline Africa team. We thank you for joining us tonight. And join us tomorrow, Sunday. I'm Douglas Mpoga.